What's better than watching your team win? Winning money while you do it. I'm Jim Costa, and on Cash the Ticket, Mike Valenti and I give you the edge to make every game playable. College football, NFL, we're breaking it all down game by game. Your podcast feed is going to be filled, and you're going to love it. You can click on the games you care about. We do it all. With our analysis, we're finding games that other people aren't talking about. We're turning every Saturday and every Sunday into days where you got a chance to win. Don't just sit on the sidelines. Cash the Ticket with us. Follow Cash the Ticket in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Hour number two here on News Radio 930 WBEN. First show of 2022. And hey, we're kicking off right where we left off in 2021 with Dave Leventhal, who was our final guest of 2021, and now he's joining the first show of 2022. Dave Leventhal, obviously, is the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief at Business Insider, also from the great Western New York region. Dave, good morning.
Hey, a pleasure and an honor to be back with you on your first show.
Now, Dave, obviously, important stuff going on here in Buffalo this afternoon. We'll get into that. But I would like to know from you, the kickoff the segment like this. 2022, obviously, a lot going on later in the year. What do you think, what do you perceive will be the big stories of the year 2022 in Washington, D.C.?
Well, COVID is going to color everything, Joe. I don't think there's any way, even if the pandemic begins to wane in relatively short fashion, as I think we all hope it will, it's still going to really touch on every aspect of policy. It's going to touch on every aspect of politics now that we're entering an election year. So no matter what is being discussed, whether it's legislation or campaigns or votes, this is going to be an issue that is front and center at the federal level. And I think communities all across the country, too, are experiencing this very acutely on the state and the local level, going all the way down to city halls and school boards as to how students should wear masks, how things should stay open or close, how vaccines should be distributed, and whether there should be mandates or not. So yeah, I think you can see where this is all going, that it's not going away anytime soon.
And starting with this week, the first full week of 2022, we had the president and vice president speak at the Capitol on the anniversary of the incidents on January 6th. It was interesting to see the vice president, but she was there. So was President Joe Biden. Dave, I thought what happened later was a little interesting. Dick Cheney made an appearance, I believe, on the Senate floor on January 6th. What was his message and what was he doing in Washington, D.C.?
Well, it was striking to see him. I mean, let's not forget the relatively recent history. Okay, if you rewind the clock, not a dozen years, Dick Cheney was effectively persona non grata number one for Democrats. He was the enemy. He was the villain. He was something out of a Batman movie, and not on the good side for Democrats. So the notion of Democrats sort of hailing Dick Cheney as, if not a hero, somebody who was more on their side than the Republican side is just absolutely incongruent with everything anyone would have known not too terribly long ago, even a couple of years ago. But Dick Cheney was there to effectively, stand side by side with Liz Cheney, his daughter, a representative from the state of Wyoming, serving in Congress, who is a Republican and who has stood in opposition to many of her Republican colleagues when it comes to the actions of Donald Trump in the Trump administration when Donald Trump was president. So as a result, Dick Cheney, the symbolism of him being there was, of course, very striking. And the fact that he's now kind of reemerged as a voice of opposition to the Republican Party as led by Donald Trump is notable. Is it going to do anything? Probably not. But at the same time, too, Democrats in this very, very strange, odd way were able to kind of chalk that up as a little moral victory for themselves on the anniversary of the attacks on the U.S. Capitol.
So that was the awkwardness of, because Dave, we all remember how Dick Cheney was treated. I mean, you mentioned Batman. Batman played Dick Cheney in a movie a few years ago. But it was weird to see him there and him being embraced by Democrats, remembering what was 12 years ago. That was a shared feeling throughout Washington.
Very much so. I think Republicans and Democrats, if they can be unified on anything, they were kind of unified in their shock at the visual of this happening right at the U.S. Capitol. I'm only, laughing here a little bit just because of how, absurd this would have seemed, again, not too long ago, because Democrats were just, viewed Dick Cheney right up there in sort of a, the axis of villains, if you will, among Republicans, and yet how things change when, of course, you have somebody like Donald Trump to serve as the enemy for Democrats. So, yeah, very, very striking. It may just be a one-off thing, and there's not much more to read into it. But it'll be curious to see if Dick Cheney, who is very much laid low over the past several years, along with George W. Bush, his president, he's relatively stayed quiet and under the radar for the most part. This emergence was definitely something that was unexpected and very striking.
Now, a message that was repeated on January 6th was the need to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Where is that right now in Congress, in Senate, and what's the likelihood of that seeing any action?
Well, this is something that, I won't go too far down the history trail here, but this is really going to come down to what the Democrats are going to do, or not do for that matter, when it comes to the filibuster. And the filibuster, this is the thing in the Senate. It is a rule. It's not a law. It's not in the Constitution. This is a construct of the U.S. Senate that sometimes Democrats have used to their great advantage. Sometimes Republicans have used to their great advantage, but right now Democrats are trying to decide whether they want to whittle away at the filibuster just a little bit to get rid of this rule that says that effectively you need 60 votes in the Senate to advance something such as this that isn't a financially tied or a motion that has a strong financial nature to it. So if you want to go forward, as the Democrats do, with voting rights bills and in sort of quote-unquote democracy-related bills, they're going to have to change the rules of the filibuster. Now, there is historical precedent to this, and very recent one, too. In 2013, Democrats changed the filibuster rules to allow certain types of judicial nominees to go forward with only a simple majority of 50 votes, not 60. And then the Republicans, a couple years later, they changed the filibuster rules so that Supreme Court nominees could go forward without 60 votes in just 50 votes. So the ball's back in Democrats' courts. They, of course, just have the barest of minimum majorities right now. It's a 50-50 Senate. The Democrats have Kamala Harris as vice president, who can cast tiebreaker votes. So they would all have to agree. They would all have to be on the same page. Somebody like Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, a Democrat, who has been sort of the intramural foil of Democrats for on many, many issues, he would have to agree. And it's unclear as to whether the Democrats are even going to have the votes to go forward. They would need help from Republicans to change this, and it's unlikely that they're going to get much help, if any help at all, from Republicans.
And speaking of Joe Manchin, seems like every time we talk, Dave, we're talking about West Virginia's Joe Manchin. You guys are reporting over at Business Insider that he got some calls trying to lobby him in support of the Senate filibuster.
Absolutely. He's getting calls from just about every corner of Republicans, Democrats, and everyone else. I mean, there's Joe Biden, the president, and there's Joe Manchin, the mini president. And that's really has been the theme of 2021 and 2022, this current congressional session, where Joe Manchin, because he is so idiosyncratic and out of step with Democratic orthodoxy and so willing to stand apart from his party, he has that ability to more or less get what he wants because he's that 50th vote. And if the Democrats don't have him, they've got a whole lot of nothing. So, yes, he is being lobbied on this. He's also being lobbied on several other things, too, not the least of which is the attempted resurrection by Democrats of the Build Back Better plan, which is Joe Biden's roughly $1.8 trillion social spending package that is really a cornerstone of his presidential agenda, which is more like the Build Back burner plan right now, because voting rights have superseded it at this point in terms of legislative priorities. So expect voting rights to be number one on the legislative agenda going into, certainly throughout this month and going into February. A potential vote is being scheduled or might be scheduled around Martin Luther King Jr. Day on the voting rights bills. You can obviously see the symbolism that is being cast as a result of that. And the Build Back Better plan may, you know, likely be kicked down the road to a later date if it's ever going to be brought back for an actual vote at all.
You know, we talked Joe Manchin. Where does Kyrsten Sinema stand with all this? She's also been kind of, you know, a voice in the middle of the Democrats in Senate. Where does she stand on the filibuster, on the Voting Rights Act? Has she made any statements on this against Joe Manchin or with Joe Manchin?
Yeah, she's likely more likely to go with the Democratic majority than not, at least on this issue. When it comes to the Build Back Better plan, she's for certain aspects of it and against certain aspects. So, for example, Joe Manchin, a few weeks back, he sort of counter-offered a plan of himself to push forward Build Back Better, but Kyrsten Sinema was really kind of aghast at a potential tax hike that would have been placed on very wealthy individuals and high earners. That was a bridge too far for her, even though it was working for Joe Manchin. So, you know, the math doesn't work that way, too, when she falls off, even if Joe Manchin is in. So they're kind of a dual threat for the Democratic leadership in the Senate and in Congress writ large, but they don't necessarily always want the same things at the same time, which makes the calculus, so to speak, that much more difficult and complex for Democratic leadership.
And staying in the Senate will be Ron Johnson. After saying he was going to retire, he will seek that third term in the Senate, that coming down just in the last hour.
It did. It was. We knew a couple of days ago that he was likely going to go in this direction. He made it official this morning, and he said back 2 years ago, he said back 6 years ago that he was going to only serve two terms, and that was going to be it. He has changed his mind, so voters can either say, "All right, that's cool. You have the right to change your mind," or they can hold him to his original promise and not vote him back into office. But expect this to be, as he seeks a third term, one of the most high profile and likely very expensive races. I wouldn't say it's going to be the most expensive Senate race in 2022, but it's going to be up there. And already you have outside organizations and party connected organizations ready to pour millions and millions of dollars into this race, even at this relatively early juncture. So if you live in the state of Wisconsin, man, expect to get communications of every sort through every medium that you could possibly conjure up for this particular race, because it is going to be an absolute Donnybrook, Joe.
Does he have Republican support, or would there be a primary with this announcement, you know, kind of going back on his word?
He's going to be the nominee. He may get token challenges, but there's no indication that there's any appetite among voters in Wisconsin, Republican primary voters in Wisconsin, to replace him on the ballot, to have a new primary, or to have a primary where a new nominee for the Republican Party would be chosen. So that has happened in recent history, but it's incredibly rare, and the conditions just don't seem to be there for that taking place in Wisconsin. So presuming that that Ron Johnson is going to be the nominee for that seat, he definitely has the support of his party overall at the national level, and that's definitely going to be a very tight race, as it often is in Wisconsin, because the state, even though it is, you know, been red or reddish, is definitely, I think you can qualify as a pretty purple state when you look at the recent history of the state's electoral votes.
Dave, we can't go talking without talking about COVID for a question. And testing seems to be an issue nationwide. Here in Erie County, the county just got 80,000 tests from the state, and our Volkswagen of Orchard Park text board is filled up with people telling us where they're sold out and where they can no longer get it. Is testing, I know the president purchased, I believe, a half a billion tests, but it seems to still be an issue throughout the country. Is the White House focusing on this? Have we heard anything about addressing the testing shortage in America?
Yeah, the White House is very focused on the issue of testing. So even though there have been just incredibly conflicting guidance and all different sorts of standards, which oftentimes are focused on the local level because these are local decisions about school openings and closings, and individual businesses are deciding for themselves how to handle the pandemic. The one thing that the federal government can do, and this is key here, and is going to be able to do in all likelihood, is use its own federal resources to get stuff to people. And what is that stuff? Well, that stuff is tests. So I think we can expect here in D.C. that there's going to be pretty clear guidance in the not too distant future about people receiving COVID tests through the U.S. mail. So effectively, the federal government mailing tests to people right at their home. They don't have to go to a pharmacy. They don't have to go to a testing center. They will be able to get at least a limited amount of tests at their home that they can use for the time being. So that would be, you know, a pretty massive, dramatic change in the way this is all going, because absolutely, I mean, I've talked to friends and family members and have asked them the question time and time again, hey, what's the testing situation like in your community? And it ranges from, oh, it's super easy. I can go to my local library and they have them for free and it takes 30 seconds and I can get a couple of books while I'm there too, to I waited in line for 2.5 hours just to get a single test and there are no rapid tests around. So it's a mess. It's a patchwork quilt all across the country. There's no consistency in how this is being applied. And oftentimes it just depends on where you live in your own local jurisdiction as to how this is being handled. So the federal government's stepping in to kind of create testing equity, if you will, via the Postal Service is something that people have been clamoring for months, and it appears that it's going to be going forward. And Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General, who, of course, has been very crosswise with the Biden administration, he was a Trump appointee, he has said that the Postal Service is ready to deliver them if, in fact, that comes to pass.
And it's interesting. You said, I waited 2 hours for a test. Our last text was, I just waited an hour for nothing. Talking about one of the locations here in Erie County that have sold out. Dave, before I let you go, big game at 425. You got a little time to think about it. You know, these later games I'm not used to, with 15 years of 1 o'clock games. Not used to these later games. How do you feel about winning the division on home turf?
I know. It's like, what am I going to do with my life? I'm going to have to, you know, go for a run or take down the Christmas tree or something here. I suspect a lot of Buffalonians are feeling the same way. Hey, all I know is that young Dave back in 1988 was sitting there in Then-Rich Stadium watching the Bills beat the Jets 9-6 in overtime to win the AFC East Championship that year. That changed my life as a Bills fan. So the opportunity today to win the AFC East again at home against the Jets is warming my heart, and I hope we do it not in, you know, thin fashion in overtime, but win the game by about 30 points and head into the playoffs on a high note.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's not 9-6. That score this season is it's very trigger. But let me tell you, 9-6, not a score I want to see on a scoreboard anytime soon. Dave, thank you so much for joining me. Go Bills. We'll talk soon.
Go Bills, indeed. Have a great day.
That is Dave Leventhal, the Deputy Bureau, Washington Deputy Bureau Chief for Business Insider. When we come back, Dr. Amish Adalja joined Brian Mazurowski and myself. We'll play part of that interview here on Hardline.
If your day sounds like,
we need the report ASAP.
You deserve Modelo. If you've persevered through, you deserve this rich golden lager with a crisp but refreshing taste. Or if you overcame,
two more.
You deserve this ice cold reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
What's better than watching your team win? Winning money while you do it. I'm Jim Costa, and on Cash the Ticket, Mike Valeni and I give you the edge to make every game playable. College football, NFL, we're breaking it all down game by game. Your podcast feed is going to be filled, and you're going to love it. You can click on the games you care about. We do it all. With our analysis, we're finding games that other people aren't talking about. We're turning every Saturday and every Sunday into days where you got a chance to win. Don't just sit on the sidelines. Cash the Ticket with us. Follow Cash the Ticket in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN, the final segment. Earlier this week, Brian Mazurowski and I spoke with Dr. Amish Adalja from Johns Hopkins University about about the current COVID-19 strategy, booster shots, and more. Here's part of that interview from Thursday.
Dr. Amish Adalja, Johns Hopkins University, is joining us on the line right now. Dr. Adalja, thanks so much for the time. We know it's a busy time for you, but wanted to get you on because, you know, it's a new year. And it really is. You can point to maybe a few weeks prior to the new year. But as we turn the calendar into 2022, it really is a different COVID picture that we're talking about as opposed to all the other times we've had discussions on the air here. And I want to start with, you know, just kind of what I think a lot of people are saying right now. I had someone close to me. He was about to go on a trip. Not anymore. Getting the COVID test to go out of the country and, oh, positive, you have COVID. You know, didn't even know it. We're looking at, you know, we're close to Toronto here. I'm looking at a story out of Canada. And the headline, I think, is saying it all to me right now. Cough, cold, or COVID-19, doctors say, with symptoms overlapping, it's impossible to tell. And when I see something like that, and you see kind of what's around you, and the severity level diminished with the new COVID variant, it leads you to a lot of questions of, all right, what are we doing here, and when are we over?
Well, I think that what you're seeing now is the fact that Omicron is basically ubiquitous, and this is not something that people are going to be able to avoid. And because the symptoms are so much overlapping with other respiratory viruses, including influenza, which are circulating again, it's very difficult to know. I think the key thing here is to get through this kind of acute phase, this acute wave of Omicron, and hope that our hospital systems are able to handle it. Because even if it is less severe on a pound-for-pound basis, if it infects more people and we still have enough high-risk unvaccinated individuals in certain communities, it could be a lot for hospitals that are already down on staffing and with capacity concerns. And I think we'll probably know this within the next couple of weeks, but that's sort of where we stand.
You spoke of it overlapping with the flu, and we heard of the first case of this flu Rona. How do you think that's going to be something that's common throughout the United States, or is it going to be just these rare instances of flu and COVID at the same time?
It's fairly rare, probably less than 10%. There's going to be less than 10% of that of the time that's going to happen. And it's interesting because they're calling this the first case. But back in 2020, we had tons of cases like that. It's just that the press didn't care at that point. So now and then they've come up with a catchy name for it now. So it's getting all these headlines. But we always knew that coronavirus and other viruses could co-infect at the same time. So I'm really puzzled by this flu-rona craze that's in the news.
The other thing that was in the news was yesterday, the FDA expanding the use of booster shots to now include people as young as 12. And this was following, you know, expanded boosters in young people already here in our state to go to the University of Buffalo or, you know, many SUNY schools. Now a booster is required in about a week's time if you want to return to campus. And, you know, I'm looking at this kind of, you know, going out. I'm very surprised we're still doing this because everything I'm reading, you know, from reliable sources would indicate, OK, we're dealing with something much milder. You know, everything we know to be true still is where if you're younger, you're less susceptible to a negative outcome. These people are already required to be vaccinated as it is. And the vaccines are holding up well to hospitalization and death, you know, amidst everybody. And here we are now requiring boosters for 18-year-olds to get their education and opening it up for people as young as 12. I think it's maybe even less than 6 months after they were first approved for the initial shots. Does this seem strange to you?
Yes, it does. And I think it's because I think people are very mixed on what their goals should be with COVID-19. And to me, it's always about preventing serious illness, hospitalization, and death. And I don't think boosting healthy people with these first-generation vaccines to give them a transient benefit to prevent mild illness really makes much sense. But for whatever reason, after the CDC initially approved them, it's really been expanded to almost everybody. And you can remember way back in the beginning, the CDC's ACIP committee voted against general boosters for people, and CDC director overrode her advisory committee. So to me, this has always been something that they've wanted to have some actionable thing for people to do, and they tell them to get boosted, and that's part of their message. Even though when I work in the hospital, and I just worked overnight in the hospital, it's not people who lack boosters that are there. It's people who lack first and second doses. And I think we have to remember that that's the most important thing. And I think it's silly that many of these universities are now requiring boosters for their students who are not going to be at risk for severe disease. I think universities should require full vaccination, but the booster doesn't make much sense for me in that group. I think boosters make sense in people who are high risk, people who are older, elderly. But outside of that, I think there's marginal value to them. And with Omicron, we see that people who are boosted are getting infected. And the thing is, I think we probably need to think about what our overall strategy is, because boosting, if we boosted everyone in the United States that needed boosted, our hospitals would still suck.
It's an interesting way to put it. And I'm wondering if we got on this line of booster and you know, we're just kind of slow to shift our mind, right? Because booster, when you're dealing with Delta, you know, might seem like a good idea based on the data you're seeing. But I'm looking at something that was released about a week ago from a scientist at the University of Toronto, who they looked at, it's about 3,500 Omicron cases, over 9,000 Delta cases, and about 500,000 test negative controls. And a third dose in providing protection. And they say it's not great protection with the booster against Omicron. Vaccine effectiveness with the third dose after 7 days, they put it at about 37%. And, you know, to kind of marry all this stuff together, when we were talking about a vaccine, we were looking at, you know, well, it needs to be 50% effective. And now we're mandating boosters to go to college for 18-year-olds, that a booster on the type of COVID that's now circulating is under that 50%. Now, you know, that's just one study, a few thousand people, but we're all kind of seeing this anecdotally, too.
Yeah, I think that this was something that was ill-conceived. And now it's going to be very hard for people to walk back these booster recommendations and booster requirements. But there really is not strong data that healthy people are going to benefit that much from it, especially with Omicron, where we know it's immune evasive. And when you're talking about populations in which a breakthrough infection is going to be exceedingly mild, it's just never been something that I thought made sense. But the political winds kind of went that way, and it became very hard. A lot of us in the field had initially opposed boosters for the general public if they weren't high-risk individuals, but we've sort of been drowned out now, and it's kind of went on, and it's now you actually get equated to being anti-vax if you're against the boosters. I get hate mail from pro-booster people now.
Dr. Dalgia, you talk about it being immune resistant, this new variant Omicron. Are we seeing now with this more cases of people getting COVID for the second time? And with that, if you do have Omicron, what does that mean for natural immunity from the next variant?
Basically, with Omicron, any immunity that you have from prior vaccination, any immunity from prior infection, is not something that's going to really stop Omicron. So we're going to basically have the whole population of the world susceptible again, based on the mutations that Omicron has. And that doesn't mean that people are all going to get serious disease. It means that if you're vaccinated, you're going to get mild disease because it doesn't erase everything that the vaccine does for you. What it means for natural immunity, what we're seeing is that there is some data that if you, after an Omicron infection, you do get a big boost of antibodies that may be protective against other variants. So, for example, you're much more protected, it seems, from laboratory studies against Delta after Omicron than you were before. So those antibodies seem to be much more cross-reactive after Omicron. I think the key thing is to remember that there's four other coronaviruses that cause 25% of our common colds, and they reinfect us every year routinely. They get around our immunity and are able to cause mild illness. Omicron might be sort of the first step that COVID-19 takes down that path. And I think it was always destined that COVID would become the fifth seasonal coronavirus, and it looks like Omicron is, you know, a sign of that, a premonition of that happening.
With Omicron so quickly spreading and so quickly becoming dominant, the dominant variant, is there going to be a time where this is, as you said, everyone's susceptible to it, where Delta becomes again the dominant variant because Omicron has moved so quickly?
I actually think Delta will probably go will become extinct, because right now we're seeing Delta cases fall rapidly. And if Omicron immunity gives you immunity to Delta, Delta's not going to have many people to infect. If everybody gets infected with Omicron, Delta just might not be able to have enough susceptible hosts to survive. So Delta may get extinguished by Omicron.
Do we have a good handle right now of, you know, hospitalizations will be under the microscope? And, you know, we have a lot of talk of that being, instead of cases, you know, looking at that is maybe giving us a clear indicator of where we are. Do we have a good idea of what type of COVID cases are making up our COVID hospitalizations? In other words, is Omicron really sending people to the hospital, or is it still just Delta? Do we have a clear grasp on that?
Increasingly, it is now Omicron. I think there are still some residual Delta patients there, and Delta has fallen to maybe about 5% of our cases overall now. But there are some Delta patients in the hospital. Omicron is sending people to the hospital. Omicron has killed people. The key thing is it's still going to be the unvaccinated high-risk individuals. And maybe, on, as I said earlier, on an individual basis, Omicron is less likely to send you to the hospital. But if there's a lot of susceptible people in a given region who have high-risk conditions, it's still, even if the hospitalization rate is lower, it still may be too much for hospitals that are under capacity concerns because of the prior Delta wave that's dissipating somewhat, and a lot because of staffing issues and the fact that many healthcare workers themselves are getting Omicron and having to be out sick.
When we hear about a booster, and as it relates to Omicron, and you know, vaccinated people, boosted people getting COVID, is there a difference between 2 and 3 doses when it comes to Omicron? Because, you know, as I'm kind of thinking about this, this vaccine, you know, targeted toward COVID as we knew it, you know, at a certain point in time over a year ago. Now with the mutation, has it mutated to the point where it doesn't matter how much vaccine you have, it's really kind of a little bit different, if you get what I'm trying to ask here?
Not completely. It depends upon who you're talking about. In the healthy population, yeah, I think what you're saying holds. But if you're talking about an immunosuppressed person or someone with high-risk conditions, they definitely should be boosted because their breakthrough infection may not be mild, and there is evidence that a third dose will help them stave off hospitalization. So for people above age 65, people with any high-risk immunosuppressing condition, they should be boosted immediately.
Would it be then a more credible policy to say, given what we know right now, when it comes to a booster shot, instead of saying, all right, let's open it up to everyone over 12 and to go back to college, you're going to need it, to say for the general population, if you're young, if you're vaccinated, you might not need it with this new variant. However, if you are over a certain age, maybe that's 65, maybe it's 60, maybe it's something else, or you have, you know, one of these comorbidities, you may need this booster shot, say, every 6 months.
I think that's probably a better policy, and that's what sort of had been articulated in the past. Yeah, unfortunately, that kind of got washed away because people got confused about who was eligible for a booster and who wasn't, and public health often like simple one-size-fits-all solutions. Just to say everybody get a booster at 6 months is much easier than saying if you have diabetes, if you have this, if you have that, get a booster. And I think that also that would have been a much more precision-guided message, and I think it would make sense, and it actually would be beneficial because it really articulates what the goals are to prevent severe illness, and maybe that changes down the line with updated boosters that may be directed against Omicron or second-generation vaccines that are more universal. But yes, I think a more targeted booster approach is what makes sense, but it's going to take some time for people to walk this back, and I don't know if they will walk it back.
Does the likelihood of rapid spread of the Omicron variant change what might be coming in terms of pediatric vaccination? You know, in other terms, if we're going to be talking about a vaccine for kids under 5 years old or for a large portion of kids, say, between 5 and 10 who have not been vaccinated, they're likely to get infected. Should that change recommendation on vaccination in those age groups?
I think it could, based on the fact that if they do get protection through immunity and this starts to evolve to a more milder, more manageable infection, that we don't necessarily have stringent requirements for children with these first-generation vaccines. What I think ultimately is going to happen is that we're going to see a much better second-generation vaccine that's used in routine childhood immunization, and I think that will be kind of the last blows with COVID-19 once it becomes something that we immunize routinely against in childhood the way we do for rotavirus or chickenpox. That may be what we see happening. But I do think that we should think about vaccine policy in light of what's going on with the virus's epidemiology and its virology. And if it's changing to a different to something different, I think that could influence vaccine policy, especially when we're using vaccines directed against the first generation of this virus. But I think it's going to be some time before all of that vaccine policy gets sorted out.
Dr. Dalsha, the CDC went from 10 to 5 days talking about quarantine. They got a lot of backlash on Twitter, a lot of people in the media even saying that they went too far. What do you think about the quarantine for those who have been infected with COVID being only 5 days compared to 10?
We've always known that a one-size-fits-all isolation period didn't make sense, that the bulk of transmission was occurring in the first half of illness. I think what the CDC was trying to do was correct, to trying to right-size the isolation period, trying to minimize the disruption to people's lives with isolation, to encourage people to get tested, because many people weren't getting tested if they faced a 10-day isolation period, and they had the science to support it. However, I think that the public health communication was very muddled, and they got very defensive. They didn't include tests, and many people thought that was because there is a shortage of home tests. Then they basically cast doubt on the value of those tests, and then they went back and then put the test back in, but kind of put it in a wishy-washy manner, saying, if you have a test and you want a test, get one on day 5, and then isolate for 5 more days if you are positive, which actually disincentivizes people to test. So I think they handled this terribly. But I think, in general, what we want to do is make isolation periods the perfect size. We want them to be precision-guided, and I think using rapid tests to say your isolation period is 4 days, yours is 7 days, that makes sense. Hopefully we get to that point, but this is creating more confusion and more backlash against the CDC, and many people have now tuned out the CDC, which is unfortunate because they are the best at what they do, but they're just so compromised in how they do it because of political being infused with politics and also just poor public health communication that to me is inexplicable.
And again, that was Dr. Amish Adalja from BMAS and Beamer earlier this week. If you'd like to hear that interview in its entirety, you can find it at WBEN.com and on the Odyssey app. That is all for Hardline today. Go Bills. We'll talk to you tomorrow morning starting at 5 a.m. here on News Radio 930 WBEN.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Norse Sides and Bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Nor Taste Combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit nor.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.
It's not just about watching the game, it's about betting on it. I'm Mike Valeni, and on Cash the Ticket, Jim Costa and I break down every college football and NFL matchup like it's the last game we're ever going to watch. From the best bets to the sneaky underdogs, and of course, as my co-host likes to say, the value. And the one thing we're not going to do is pretend we're professionals. We have fun with it, it's an entertainment product, and it makes watching games a hell of a lot of fun. So Cash the Ticket, follow it in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.